It's not a given that a robot can't have an ethical program. They're ubiquitous, they're reliable, we know what they're gonna say, and they're always gonna be loyal, except insofar as they're selling your secrets to the highest bidder.
Welcome to Cambridge Forum in Harvard Square to discuss a growing and all-pervasive social development, the presence of robots. Remember back when robots were touted merely as tools, as handy replacements for putting people in dangerous or monotonous situations out of that. Think of the metal humanoid C-3PO from Star Wars, or even the lovely Wall-E. Well, all that's changed in the past 5 years. The role and range of robots has morphed into something beyond all expectation. Bots are now big business and a large part of our lives. We converse with them on our phones, in our cars, and in our homes. They are our new personal assistants, servicing our needs, listening to our commands and our problems. But what else are they doing? Are they spying when they are monitoring our emotions? And why are we bringing these bots into our lives? And what is the price that we're paying for this convenience? I'm Mary Stack, I'm director of the Cambridge Forum, and tonight we have two wonderful speakers to help us navigate this new world order. Judith Shulevitz got my attention straight away with her November cover story for Atlantic Monthly, which was entitled, Alexa, Should We Trust You? In the essay, she examined the social and psychological effects of voice-activated technology in the present and the future. Judith is a critic, author, and journalist. She's been a columnist at the New York Times Book Review, Slate. She was a science editor at the New Republic, and she's contributed essays and articles to New York Magazine and Atlantic Monthly. To join her, we have Maxime Pozdorovikin, an award-winning director-producer based in New York. His most recent feature, The Truth About Killer Robots, premiered at the 2018 Toronto Film Festival and was broadcast on HBO Documentaries. Well, before we go any further, I think I'd like to invite anybody who wants to ask questions of our informed people to come up and pose some.
A number of years ago, I heard Rodney Brooks, the inventor of iRobot, talk about the necessity of programming somehow Asimov's three laws of robotics into all robots. Is anybody programming ethical laws into robots?
I mean, I think that engineers tend to have major kind of ethical blind spots, but even the example of Asimov's laws is always introduced as this way, is that this is what we should do. But if you actually read the stories, what he does is say that, I think it's 2048, that's when he sets the story. I could be wrong on that. But that basically by that point, there will be enough robots all around that these incidents of kind of accidents or fatal accidents will be common enough where you will need laws. That's the premise of the stories. But then what every single story shows is that no matter what law you pass, they will fail because humans are complicated, context is complicated, all these things. So I think that the necessity is there and regulation is there, but there's also, one shouldn't be blinded by this idea that once you integrate that, who knows what that would even look like, that it would solve the problem.
Yeah. There is on the question of the ethical robot, there is a novel coming out by Ian McEwan, who wrote Atonement and other novels like that, called Machines Like Me, that I just read the advanced galley proofs. And it deals with a robot whose ability to reason ethically is far more sophisticated than the humans he is living with. But he has a sort of Peter Singer-like utilitarianism in the sense that he wants the greatest good for the greatest number. That's his ethical framework. And it ends up being, fatal for the people, or terrible anyway, not always fatal, for the people he lives with, because he's such a great moral reasoner, but he starts from a questionable premise. But it's not a given that a robot can't have an ethical program.
I think Nick Bostrom has the paperclip experiment, where I think that a lot of times that the vast majority of robots will not fall into malevolence or sort of good deeds. They will just have a very, very narrowly defined, you know, purpose for their existence, and they will sort of pursue, and as they get more intelligent, they will just be more and more clever at pursuing that one purpose. So, and I think that the Nick Bostrom experiment is a robot that just makes paper clips, but will go to such extreme lengths to continue making paper clips that he destroys humanity.
Right. And then there's this whole other thing. There's an audio computing expert in Germany named Bjorn Schuller, who is very interested in sort of mapping out on a graph where all the human emotions are and the shades are, and finding those locations where he feels there's no emotion associated with it. And he says those are the locations where robots will sort of fill in and have robot emotions. And I'm blanking on her name, the creator of Jibo. What's her name? Oh, Cynthia Brazil has talked about how, you know, her Jibo and her creations, she believes, will begin to have authentically robotic emotions that are theirs and not ours. Kind of cool.
Given that the percentage of robots now which are really doing good for humanity compared to those that are just trying to sell us something or influence our behavior and even emotions, such in Facebook, how are we going to get this realization out to more people? I wonder if perhaps the vocabulary that we use is a little prescriptive. We call them assistants. What if we called them friendly-sounding spies? Which
friendly.
Is what they are these days, isn't it?
Yeah, that's what they are. They're always ubiquitous. They're reliable. We know what they're going to say, and they're always going to be loyal. You know, except insofar as they're selling your secrets to the highest bidder, you know.
The question I think of, I always, with this topic, I keep on going back to the question of language. And even when I myself talk about some of these things, let's say some of the consequences of automation, I'm surprised at the fact that I feel squirmy, let's say, using the word dignity, that it somehow it feels slightly corrupt for describing for manufacturing labor as having any kind of dignity. And part of that, I think part of the discomfort is because we see it on humans shouldn't have to do this work. But that's looking at it just through the calculus of what they're doing. You know, in a lot of these productions, they're gathering with other people. They have some kind of social intercourse. They have some kind of status that they establish and they can realize themselves. And all that stuff kind of gets lost when you look at it exclusively through the GDP, through the filter of GDP and efficiency and return on investment and production.
Right.
And what I find so fascinating is that even when people talk about it sympathetically, they express concern for what will happen for automation. It's still through those parameters. It's still using the language of economics. It's still kind of approaching it only through that kind of lexicon.
I thought you were going to go to a different place, which is this idea that we tend to dismiss as satisfying or as having human dignity, you know, sort of work on an assembly line, work that is a sort of designed by automation, right? But as you say, they have unions, they have communities. I'm working on something about, mill workers, young female mill workers of the 19th century who had all these educational societies and, you know, all kinds of things and they were so happy. These girls were so happy to get off the farm and work at these mills and be around other young women. So it's not necessarily, it doesn't necessarily lack dignity. And it's definitely true that the thing that most lacks dignity is not having a job and not having a source of income or not having a thing that you do.
Well, I think we're just looking at one end of the labor market here. I mean, I just read a report Mother Jones did on the future of work, and they said you're delusional if you don't think this is going to affect high-skilled labor. It's nothing to do with just blue-collar. Surgeons are going to be replaced.
Yeah.
It's much more effective and efficient to have someone who can work for indefinitely with no breaks or downtime.
Yeah, it's going to be, it's actually the sector that's going to be most heavily hit in the immediate term is drivers, right? Truck drivers, all drivers. But eventually the sector that's going to be decimated is middle management, basically. So any sort of accounting, any sort of anything that is within an industrial or organizational process that can't be rationalized. So the middle manager, basically, who just makes sure that the quotas are met or supervises the workers, that's going to go. You don't need humans for that.
Well, in the service sector, you know, I just walked in and got a drink at CVS beforehand, and you sort of, the job of the people there now just to make sure that you use the iPad correctly.
Right.
You know, so.
Yeah.
But I'm also worried about the actual culture being lost. Our actual culture, we're giving it away. I mean, humanity, our values. I mean, how do you program values into a robot?
But even those kinds of connections, a connection that you can have with a person at a cash register, even at the level of looking at another person in the eye, those things are important in that having them throughout your day does make you feel more human, just like, you know, certain kinds of democratic institutions, whether it's like the post office or the army, would force you to confront people that aren't like yourself. And in a way, now we're just confronting ourselves via the narcissism and the
self-image. You have that beautiful image in your movie of that girl who goes to the 24-hour store, which is totally automated, and it's sort of this lighted space in the Black Night. It's very, it's haunting, beautiful.
We have a scene which is basically a day in the life of a Chinese blogger who has no interactions with a human during the whole day. And part of that, what we wanted to realize is that China has this tremendous advantage in terms of data for behavior, because in China they didn't have credit cards that much, they weren't that widespread, so they effectively leapfrogged the credit card portals, and now everyone just pays with WeChat, which is like the Swiss Army app, the biggest app in the world that everyone uses. And so China now has tremendous amount of data about what people do, not just online, not just with their phone, but out in the physical world. And as a lot of the dynamic marketing becomes smarter and smarter outside all around you in supermarkets and refrigerators and supermarkets, that will be much more dependent on data that people create in the physical world, the way that they move through space.
The reason why I walked up here was more about community and sense of community, and that it's vital for people's mental health and the health of our society for people to be in community and have real connections. But I'm also concerned about people that are in their house pretending to communicate with somebody when they're really not. And, you know, this, the whole breakdown of what's going to keep people sane, you know. So I don't know what your reaction to that is or how, you know, it's possible to turn some of this around.
I'm not sure I actually believe that social media and, you know, the technology we're currently using, let's set aside the technology we're going to be using, is actually resulting in thinner communities. I mean, I'm just extrapolating from my own life. I keep in much closer touch with my relatives, and okay, I'm not allowed to use FaceTime anymore, but I used to, I did, you know, and was able to see, you know, babies who would not otherwise have been able to see and then who can see me and get to know me. You know, I run into somebody I've had a, you know, Twitter interaction with on the street, and we have a little bond there that we wouldn't have had otherwise. Possibly there's a sort of question of time management, like if I'm spending all this time on these devices, I'm not, you know, in the civic groups that Robert Putnam worried were disappearing. But I actually think that there's a case to be made that social media and the sort of technology we have now can make relationships thicker or communities thicker and not thinner. Not to be, you know, Pollyannish about it, but
I think anything that's as momentous and as transformative as the things that we're talking about obviously creates all these different effects and has all these different consequences and for different generations as well. And that's why I feel like being trapped in the prism of thinking about, okay, I'm using my phone too much, let me try to use my phone to connect with people, or rather than looking just passively, I'm going to kind of do something more active and connect. But I think that what happens is, and this is the stuff that's harder to talk about, is that the ways in which the ability to connect slips away. What happens to you when you're interacting in a place and you just feel the urge to check your phone? And it's those things and the way that that they're corrosive that I think is more problematic. Because I think that, again, there's always the great delusion of our age is techno-optimism. And it's this idea that basically we've lost faith in the government being able to do anything or any big problems getting changed. But we still, because of how much marketing is sort of in our atmosphere, we still sort of believe that technology and gadgets will in some way kind of solve global warming and inequality and all these things. And we're, you know, we have tremendous blinders as a result of having imbued that, and it's impossible to kind of get away
from
that.
Right, and this is Sherry Turkle's real objection to, you know, these sort of, for example, Paro, the baby seal that is used to give companionship to, you know, people in Japanese assisted living communities and things like that, is, you know, and these artificial companions don't push back. They're not rude, they're not difficult, they're not sulky, they don't resent you. They don't force you to do the difficult emotional work of actually having a relationship. And that is the problem. Now, again, I personally believe there is no reason that can't be programmed into your robot, your personal robot. There is no reason the robot can't push back and be difficult. But we are not learning with the way we've structured them as subservient and unworthy of dignity and honor. We are not learning the tools of having a relationship.
Well, I think the question is, do we want a relationship? I think that's the key question.
Or do they want us to have a relationship?
Yes,
because
exactly.
I think that they want the relationship to be with you and your own desires.
Right, because Jennifer raised an interesting point just then when she said, you know, are we losing humanity? It's okay if I was housebound and I had no ability to get out and about, maybe it would be nice to have Alexa talking to me morning, noon, and night. You know, maybe that would give me this illusion.
If Alexa were a little smarter, and that's what
well,
we have done.
Well, whatever she does, I could program her to read me books or whatever it was.
Yeah.
Maybe that would give me some semblance of a feeling of I had this relationship or somebody to talk to. Mm-hmm. But that is not a substitute for a person, nor do I ever want it to be. I have a friend who works in research at BU, and he's totally... really wired up about robots. He said, wouldn't it be wonderful to have a man you could come home to? These robots now, they feel like people. These Japanese robots, they can't keep them on the shelves, he said. And he said he could cook you French meals and he could read you poetry. And I said, no, I don't ever want someone that is not going to have an argument with me.
And see, and what happens is by doing that, by accepting that, all we do is basically redefine what our idea of connection is. And then we say that, okay, let's define connection or intelligence as this, this, and this. Mm-hmm. The ability to deliver five things or six things
right.
to you.
And most of them are services.
Yeah, and most of them are services. But even if it was an emotional thing, it's still impoverishing, let's say, by the depth of human relationships to say that, okay, if you can act like a therapist, like a Rogerian therapist, when you sense that the tone and the voice is edging towards depression, that's what human connection is.
It's so funny because I'm usually the one being the Cassandra here, but you're such downers. I keep wanting to be positive. What if Cynthia Brazil and my friend in Germany are right, and there are specifically robotic emotions that we can't have, and that we will have to grapple with, and then we will start having real relationships with robots.
I'm not sure what robotic emotions are, though, what that would mean, if it's just sort of behaviors based on pattern recognition and data, that doesn't make sense to us. I don't know. I don't want to call those emotions.
Well, they could be. It could be some strategic something that allows them to get from point A to point B as they have been programmed to do. But I don't.
This is like the inner drama of a Roomba.
Yes, exactly. The inner drama.
The psychodrama of a Roomba's journey.
Yes. No, I said if. Then maybe this is a complete fantasy, but I like to think about it as a possibility.
First off, just a quick anecdote on the notion of voice bots perhaps shifting behavior, you know, with the robocalls coming in. I've developed a habit of, you know, I would initially listen and then I'd hang up with frustration. And, you know, over the last year, I've gotten more habitual around just quickly hanging up. And then before, when I'd get an actual call, I habituated myself to being at least polite, you know, before getting off the phone. But a few weeks ago, I got an actual call and I just hung up. So in a sense, it was your example around, you know, would you cut off a self-driving vehicle because it doesn't have any emotion? If you do that repeatedly, will you then become, you know, a worse driver? And I think I've become
a jerk.
A jerk.
Wait. So let me drill down on
telemarketers.
Let me drill down on this. You hung up because there was a pause.
No. Well.
there was that pause that you always get with telemarketers before the voice comes on. And when I hear that, I hang up. So, right, well, like, if someone called and then, like, was like, I would just hang up on them.
No,
right?
No, no, but
so
this time I knew it was real. You know, it was this time it was a real call coming in, but I was rude in a way that I wouldn't have been. But anyway, my question, though, is having read the work of Yuval Harari, Sapiens, and Homo Deus, he's now got 21 Rules of the 21st Century, one of his premises is around medical technology and biotech, and that as that field advances, the notion of immortality is, you know, potential out there. It's even for my children, you know, he would suggest, may live to 500 or 600 years. If they have the means, and that technology is not being distributed evenly, and that for those who have the means could live and actually become super healthy, and with genetic modifications and genetic engineering, you're going to develop sort of this super species, Homo Deus, right, that's separate from Homo sapien, and we'll move towards, I think that the interesting point is moving towards a more authoritarian kind of future, not more democratic, but more authoritarian. In a sense.
Well, we would certainly move toward a gerontocracy, right? There'd be a lot of old people, and there wouldn't be room for any young people.
Certainly that. And that may not be so bad, having nice old people around. You know, but I think his... maybe people should just let go. But the point is that access to that kind of care cannot be made available to 10 billion people, and that we're going to be, the division between rich and poor is going to become greater.
Yeah,
and I think a lot of us, you know, in the 70s, 80s, 90s, we projected a very different future, one of great equity. You know, here we are in, you know, Unitarian Universalist Church. We imagine something different.
I mean, I think the problem, I think, so I happen to live in a gerontocracy. I live on the Columbia campus. And universities are the great gerontocracies of our time, right? Because there's no retirement age required, and you know, the average age of the professoriate is, I don't know where it is, it's in the 60s somewhere. And you see how, in fact, the elderly monopolize the resources and make it impossible for the young to sort of come up. And this is a sort of demographic image of the kind of concentration of power and wealth at the top that, you know, you talk about in your movie, and that is, you know, sort of a factor in inequality in our time. And there has to be some way to redistribute the goods. That's what we're looking at. This gets me to my favorite pet obsession, which is universal basic income, which tragically is now associated with people like Elon Musk. I say tragically because that discredits it in my book. But we're going to have find some way to redistribute wealth once work has come to an end. And all the resources are hoarded by either this gerontocracy or by what is actually happening by the, you know, the technological magnates.
You know, I struggled a lot with universal basic income as a thing, because I felt that, you know, you're absolutely right, but we're at this strange time where if you listen to, like, Thomas Piketty, let's say the darling of left-wing economists, and you listen to Steve Bannon, they're actually saying the exact same thing, that when you have this level of inequality, the only two pathways is sort of right-wing populism and left-wing populism.
Right.
I had this tension inside of whether to include universal basic income in the movie or not. And the reason that I didn't is because my thought was that automation is so encompassing and it's so transformative in all these different ways. And we live in a time where sort of the great tragedy of the age is the sort of delusion that you could watch a TED talk and learn theoretical physics in 10 minutes. And especially in documentaries, there's this sort of push to offer a solution to this. Mm-hmm. And I am so fearful of either positive tax income credits or universal basic income becoming seen as a solution, because you could just as easily create a class of people who are just like addicted to Oxycontin with Oculus Rifts, like enjoying VR and, you know, living the semi-vegetative states on their $10,000 stipend a year. So I feel like that putting too much at this point into that possibility as a solution is a little dangerous.
At the moment, and for the past 20 or 30 years at least, the benefits and the miseries of automation have been very unevenly spread. There are still factories in China where our iPads are produced, Foxconn City in particular, where 300,000 people work, and the suicide rate is way above normal. And we used to deal with factories. When you bought a Ford, you knew it came from the Ford factory. But now we deal with marketers such as Amazon and Apple and Google, and we never see what goes on in the factories. In fact, the factories have put up nets to keep people from successfully killing themselves in order to get changes in labor laws and regulations. 150 people had to threaten to jump off the top of the building. So not everybody's benefiting, and the benefits and the miseries don't seem to be evenly distributed.
Here's a man who has actually filmed at the Foxconn factory in China, so you can talk about it.
You know, I think that there's one thing that happened, and if you look at it historically, is that initially when factories, manufacturing began to be automated, there was this burst of 10 or 15 years of news reporting, which is very similar to the reporting of today about sort of how manufacturing jobs will disappear. But what happened is that humans had a tremendous advantage in terms of precision, in terms of fine motor skills, and essentially what things you could do with your finger. So as manufacturing shifted to things like the production of electronics, humans held on to this competitive advantage of working with tiny little screws. And that's what still, when you go to the Foxconn factories and their satellite factories, that's still the jobs that they do, and some QC jobs, kind of like helping you with the iPad at CVS. Now, in the last 10 to 15 years, there's just been a combination of machine learning and improvements in precision, in manufacturing precision, really created this sort of watershed moment where much more of that manufacturing, which was safe from automation, is being very actively automated, and China is investing very actively in robotic technology. So I feel like it's almost like the syndrome of like the boy who cried wolf, because there was such kind of, robots are so kind of, you know, trendy, and people predicted this kind of cataclysmic displacement for so long. I think that now we're not quite grappling with it because we're having trouble believing it in a certain way.
So the next question, also related to the mills, is what happens when the factories leave? There's usually a period of disaster. No factory. There are many churches that have been around for hundreds of years and buildings, but no factory has ever existed for more than 160 years. Factories, you know, have left Michigan, and you want to take, the city doesn't have enough money to provide water, so they outsource the water supply in Flint and end up poisoning people. Factories leave devastation in their wake. What's going to happen in China when all these factories are closed?
You know, I think that for a long time, the elasticity of the service sector was this thing that allowed us to take our eye off the automation of manufacturing. But right now, what's happened as a result of also a lot of these other parallel advances is that as parts of the service sector are being automated, there's less place for the manufacturing workers to go. Whereas traditionally, when agriculture and the amount of agricultural workers required, you know, became significantly less, those workers moved into manufacturing. So as we're moving, there's just not going to be enough sectors for workers to move into, and you're not really going to be able to just educate your way out of it just because the numbers don't quite add up. Wow. But it's a tragedy what you're describing, all those things.
And on that joyful note.
Any cheerful final thoughts?
Not really. That's pretty depressing. I mean, I am curious to know what I recommend, even though it's actually not one of McEwen's better novels. I recommend his novel where you have a robot that is more ethical than the human, and it's an interesting flip.
Well, thank you, Judith Shulevitz and Maxim Hozdoroving, for your kind participation and enlightenment. You have been listening to Living with Robots, a Cambridge Forum event being recorded live in Harvard Square. Cambridge Forum is sponsored by Lowell Institute, the Massachusetts Cultural Council, Harvard Bookstore, and the Ford Hall Forum. Thank you for joining us, and please come again.